Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. In a morally confused and morally minimized age, one of the things we have to watch is the loss of vocabulary. Last week, in the aftermath of the awful tragedy at Virginia Tech, you'll notice that Americans began using a vocabulary. They had to go back and retrieve some words that perhaps many of them had not used comfortably for some time, such as evil. That's an indispensable word. So is the word chastity. It's another one of those words that in a morally confused age has to be recovered if there's going to be any sanity among us. In just a few moments, we're going to have the opportunity for a conversation with Dawn Eden, who is the author of The Thrill of the Chaste, and she has really started something in terms of a national conversation with her book. It's going to be a fascinating conversation on this program. We'll get to that in just a moment. First, to review some issues in the news. The Independent of London is reporting that Britons are not just taking vacations for fun anymore. This is another window into the soul of a contemporary culture. Martin Hinkman, who is the consumer affairs correspondent for one of Britain's major newspapers, says that from yoga retreats in Thailand to seaweed wraps in Torquay, Britons are alleviating the stress of the 21st century by going on well-being holidays, that is, vacations, to bolster body and mind. Research shows more people are taking breaks at home and abroad to seek relaxation, beauty treatments, or cosmetic surgery, while fewer opt for the traditional beach holiday. Increasingly popular vacation activities include weight loss treatments, detox diets, mineral and thermal skin treatments, and massage and cosmetic surgery such as breast enlargement. Very, very interesting. You're looking here at a phenomenon that gives us a window into the soul. Once upon a time, most holiday makers were happy to return home with a suntan and basically some fun, said one authority. In the future, they'll be bringing back a greater sense of well-being, a major life shift, a new look, and maybe even some body parts, end quote. Why would this be a glimpse into the soul of a culture? It's because we are now so narcissistic, we're now so self-absorbed, and we're now so artificial in so many of our concerns that it's no longer enough to take a vacation with your family in order to spend the time with each other, devoted to the recovery of a genuine understanding of leisure. Now you have to come back a new you. You have to come back with, having had a seaweed wrap. I'm sure that's inexpensive and useful. Or having gone on a yoga retreat, or, and this is what's far more interesting and genuinely far more insidious, coming back after cosmetic surgery or all the rest. We are beginning to show the signs of a culture that is so narcissistic and focused also on a false view of the aesthetic that we have to come back from vacation looking like a new person, feeling like a new person. And we also buy into this idea that if we just create or purchase the right experience, we'll come back as a totally fulfilled person. There's an emptiness in the soul of individuals who feel this way. There's an emptiness in a society where this would become such a consumer reality that a major newspaper would note this as a business trend. On issues of life and death, we continue to watch what goes on not only in the United States but around the world. Right now, there is a major criminal court case going on in Germany, a trial in which a woman who styled herself the angel of death, a German nurse, is charged with killing six patients with lethal drug overdoses. She says she was doing so to end their suffering. The prosecution in Germany says she came to see herself as, quote, a mistress over life and death. There seems to be a pattern of similar cases in Germany in recent months and years. The nurse, known only as Irene B., confessed to killing four seriously ill patients at Berlin's Charity Hospital by giving them lethal overdoses of medicine. Quoting her, she said, "In all four cases, I believe that I was acting in the interest of the patients and in the end for their own good." I want to go back to what the prosecution said in Germany. They said that she styled herself as, and this is a quote, "a mistress over life and death," end quote. Now, what's really interesting there is this avoids getting to the more important issue. The prosecution, of course, is trying her for breaking the criminal code of Germany. That's a human law. And a human court and a human prosecutor are doing the human thing and the right thing in terms of the judicial process, bringing her in for trial. But the bigger issue really going on here has to do with the fact that what we're talking about is not someone who would merely be the mistress over life and death, but would play the part of God, would put herself in the position of the sovereign creator of all human beings, and she would herself decide when someone should live and when someone should die. It's not just becoming the master over life and death. It's the understanding that the only one who is the master over life and death is God himself. This is what makes euthanasia such a slippery issue. It's because I think there are an awful lot of Americans right now who would buy into the logic of Nurse Irene B. They would buy into the logic that we do, or at least should have, the ability to end suffering on our own terms. This is an insidious argument. It's the kind of argument that gets us right into the heart of the culture of death. This takes us right into the determination not only to do the kinds of things we would try to excuse ourselves doing, but right to the arrogance of the one who would take upon oneself the perquisites of a sovereign God. In Mexico, the issue of abortion is being debated, and what we see there is a major culture shift in the nation, which has been, of course, overwhelmingly Catholic now for centuries. And when the issue of abortion is coming up as it has come up in Mexico right now, the way it's framed right now, it is a clear indication that there's an underlying secularism, even in Mexico, that is somehow hidden underneath a very official and widespread Catholicism and supposed religious devotion. This Catholic country, which has been considered a regional trendsetter, according to the Washington Post, on social issues, now has a legislature that is expected to approve a law that would decriminalize abortion and allow the procedure during the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. The issue has set off a clash between powerful forces, according to the paper. On the one side are the feminists and left-leading politicians who have strengthened their control of Mexico City's government. On the other side is the Catholic Church, which failed to stop legalization of gay civil unions in Mexico City and in the northern state of Chihuahua in recent months. Now, what you're looking here is at the city of Mexico City, as right now the legislative unit considering the legalization of abortion. But as Mexico City goes, inevitably so will go the nation. The same way that in this country, the legalization of abortion spread from one state to another until eventually with the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, it was nationalized. And the logic of nationalization is that if it's a constitutional right in one state, it must be in another. It's the basic flaw of Roe v. Wade, but nonetheless, it's a logic that has teeth in terms of popular consciousness. We should expect to hear more from Mexico about this case. And it's another reminder to us that when you look at the phenomenon of modernity of the modern age, you understand that if you scratch back from an awful lot of apparent religious practice, you still have an underlying secular worldview. And this is certainly true in the United States, not just looking over the border to the south and saying, look at the Mexicans and look how thin their religion is, how thin their commitments are, if they're actually moving so fast towards abortion. It reminds me of a British sociologist of religion, and you may have heard me quote this before, who says that he's very frustrated and frankly tired of dealing with all the polls showing how supposedly committed to Christianity Americans are. He says all an American pollster needs to hear is a man cussing out his dog, and he assumes it's a major faith statement. And that's pretty much what we face in an awful lot of these polls and surveys. The reality is it's pretty thin on the ground in the United States as well. In Louisiana, yes, Louisiana, high school proms are right front and center in the news. Dozens of girls were turned around and turned away from a prom at Higgins High School in Marrero, Louisiana, because the supervising teacher thought their dresses were too revealing. And what's really revealing is the story. Families of the girls said the teacher cited alleged violations of the Jefferson Parish School's dress code, most of them related to excessive displays of cleavage. Miranda Mellarine, age 17, a senior at the high school, said, "I was embarrassed. We can't go back to prom night. Prom's over. Our prom has been stolen from us." Now, here again, it's one thing to hear this from juveniles. We expect juveniles to act in a juvenile way. We expect adolescents to reflect an adolescent logic. She positions herself here as the victim. Her prom has been taken from her. That's why you have a supervisory teacher. That's why you have rules. That's why you have a dress code in the Jefferson Parish schools there in Louisiana. But what really ought to have your concern is the fact that so many of the parents of these girls and the families of these girls, instead of being embarrassed by the actions of their own children, and instead of using this as an opportunity to teach their children something about modesty and propriety in terms of dress and decorum, instead of showing a reverence for sexuality and a reverence for the body, instead what you have are parents now contending that the rights of their children were infringed because their children could not wear what they consider to be adequately sexually suggestive clothing to the high school prom. You know, just recently a major study came out from a British think tank saying that adolescent issues really haven't changed all that much over the last 50 or 60 years. When I look at that, I have to say, well, you know, the underlying issues are probably pretty much the same. Authority, sex, education, parents, it's all there, dress, appearance, and all the rest. I think what's changed, though, is the fact that parents have forgotten what it means to be a parent. And now the kids are pretty much running the show, they're hiring the attorneys, and they're demanding to be let in their prom, no matter how little they want to wear. We're living in an interesting age. The whole issue of chastity sounds like an antique to so many people. Its antiquarian tone reminds us of the need to recover a moral vocabulary that is necessary for the world to make sense. We'll be back for a conversation with Dawn Eden, author of The Thrill of the Chaste. You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program. One of the realities of our age is that so much moral knowledge has been lost. It's not lost as in it somehow just disappeared. It's lost because it has been forgotten by many people. And we have a culture of denial, a culture that in many ways actually celebrates the triumph of overcoming a moral vocabulary that considered itself repressive, oppressive, and intolerant, restraining, captivating, and all the rest. We are, as one famous philosopher said, prisoners of our language. And there are people who want to get rid of words because they want to be liberated from what those words very insistently connote. One of those words is chastity. The word chaste. It's very interesting. If you were to do a search of literature just 100 years ago, you would discover that to be a common word. If you were to do a search of literature from the English language, especially, say, from the time of Shakespeare and Elizabeth I onward, you would discover that this is one of the main words used in connection with what it means to be a human being and what it means to honor and respect what it means to be fully human, to protect certain aspects of life about which one properly must be chaste. Well, now the word sounds, so strange to some ears that they wonder how it could possibly be revived. Well, it's being revived. And one of the agents of its revival is Dawn Eden. She's the author of the book The Thrill of the Chaste. It is published by W Publishing Group, and it's created quite a storm on the both sides of the Atlantic, which makes it a lot of fun for the conversation today. Dawn Eden is also deputy news editor at New York Daily News. She's a former rock historian. She has her own blog, The Dawn Patrol, and she's well-known also as a figure in the media. She's right now in the studio here at the Albert Mohler Program. Dawn Eden, welcome.
Thanks so much. It's great to be on.
Well, you have actually been on the program before as a guest by phone, and it's just great to have you here in the studio.
Oh, thank you. And I love it here in Louisville. The campus is beautiful.
Well, we're very glad to have you here, and especially to talk about something of this interest and importance. You know, you chose the word chaste. And perhaps we just ought to spell it. In good recovery of a vocabulary form, let's just spell it. C-H-A-S-T-E. Why is that word in the title of your book?
That word is in the title of my book because I want to show people that the concept of chastity goes beyond mere abstinence. There's this feeling among people, including people in the church, that you can teach abstinence to teenagers, but once they lose their virginity, the best we can hope for when they're in their 20s and 30s is just to get them married. And then people wonder why the divorce rates of Christians are comparable to those of the secular world. And the answer is that too many people have gotten married without learning how to develop intimate relationships that are not dependent upon sexual contact.
Because of the special nature of this conversation today, we're not going to be taking questions from callers. As a matter of fact, on a subsequent program, we're going to come back to this issue and take those calls and have that conversation. But right now, I want to maximize the time with Dawn Eden here in the studio. And I want to share with you some material you really need to hear. This is one of those paragraphs that to me ought to be a neon for thoughtful persons to be forced to think about. Listen to this. Dawn Eden argues, but chastity didn't disappear. Like the early Christians in the Roman catacombs, it went underground. Today, as the fruits of the sexual revolution prove to be loneliness, divorce, and disease, chastity is not only back, it's the new revolution. so out, it's in. Now, how can something be so out that it's in?
It's countercultural. When the culture touts the quote-unquote values of Sex and the City, if a single adult, especially one who's had some sexual experience, decides this isn't fulfilling for me, this isn't preparing me to have a lasting marriage when I meet the right person, and then that person decides to opt out of the casual dating scene or opts to not have premarital sex even if he or she's in a relationship, that person is a real rebel.
Well, you had one time been anything but a rebel. At one time, you really kind of found yourself in the middle of what you might call this highly sexualized society that considers chastity the problem rather than the solution. At one time, you said that you actually, and I'm quoting you here, had dutifully followed the Cosmo rule. Now, what was that?
The Cosmo rule is the idea that sex should push the relationship. My parents split up when I was 5 years old, and I had to witness, you know, my mother going out to have sleepovers at her boyfriend's home. So there was no ideal instilled in me that sex was something for marriage. I just thought growing up that sex was something that grown-ups did because they wanted to. And so when I started to become sexually active, I believed that I deserved pleasure. I wanted to be in love. I wanted to get married. But I thought that if I wasn't meeting the right person to marry, that, you know, according to magazines like Cosmo and the rest of the popular culture, I had every right to just have sex with whomever, whenever I pleased.
Now, you were at that time also associated with the rock culture, and so don't those things kind of go hand in hand?
Oh, very much so, and I don't believe that rock and roll is intrinsically evil, but I think that with that culture, as with certain other cultures, you know, people can use it as a substitute for spirituality, and certainly the kind of people who I was around, you know, being a music obsessive myself, the people in the music business, the musicians, they were people who got a kind of spiritual high from music, so they didn't seek out something more, something
yeah.
beyond that.
I think the culture to me is the issue there, because in many ways the whole rock music culture has become infused throughout the larger American culture in terms of its understanding of the good life, in terms of the fact that its messages are really both driving and driven by larger cultural movements. And one of those is what you also reflect in your writings as the universal single-person rule in our secular age. The universal single-person rule. Let's just talk about that. This goes back to that Cosmo rule you talked about. The average person in this society who doesn't understand chastity and would see chastity or abstinence as the problem rather than the solution follows this rule, you say, in which sex should push the relationship. I want you to play that out just a little bit more, because I think what we need is the diagnosis of the problem. It's not just sexual promiscuity. That in many ways is the product of this mentality. What you're suggesting is the idea that the only way you can have a relationship is if you're also having sex. The only way you can actually discover a relationship with someone is if you're also discovering them sexually. You're arguing that, as I understand it, that is more or less the rule writ large in the culture.
It is, and even in my own family, I remember that when I was having problems with a boyfriend, once a family member said to me, "Well, you can't refuse him sex," with the implication being that once I had started having sex with this boyfriend, sex was supposed to make our relationship deeper and more intimate.
Well, I think now you can see why the recovery of the word chastity represents nothing less than a revolution. It's the kind of revolution many of us hope and pray for. There are a lot of words out there that are used even by many Christians talking about recovering moral sanity. You know about sexual purity, we're talking about virginity, sexual abstinence. I think one of the things Don Dindis helps us to see is that the word chastity becomes a very important part of that vocabulary that helps to deepen the moral meaning of what we're talking about here. We'll take that further when we come back. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Because of the special guest we have in the studio today, we're not going to be taking calls. We will turn to those calls in a subsequent edition of the program. Our guest today is Dawn Eden. She is the blogger at the Dawn Patrol. She is also a news editor at the New York Daily News. She is also the author of The Thrill of the Chaste, a major book that's really creating a great deal of conversation. The recovery of the word chastity, I have argued, is a part of the necessary recovery of moral sanity in our age. I want to come back and ask Dawn to help us put some teeth into this definition. When we're talking about chastity here, we're talking about marriage. It's
right.
It's inseparable
that's
from
right.
marriage.
That's right, it is. And one of the things that I argue in my book is that, you know, there are, my book is geared towards women, so I'm speaking of women, although this really applies to men as well. There are women who will say, well, I don't go out and have casual sex. I'm not like the women on Sex in the City, but I don't see anything wrong in having sex if I'm in a loving relationship, if it's a committed relationship. And what I argue in my book is that all sex outside of marriage is emotionally and physically damaging because it requires one to emotionally detach. You know, as Christians, we're not dualists. We don't believe that there's the body and then separately there's the soul. We believe that everything we do with our body has to, by its nature, affect our soul as well. So if I was having sex, even within a loving, committed relationship, I was giving myself completely and fully with my body because it's the most self-sacrificing act you can perform with your body. But because we were not married, both my partner and I each had an easy out. Neither of us had signed a piece of paper. It's much easier to walk out of a relationship when you're not married than when you are. So knowing this, it would have been too painful for me to give myself completely emotionally while giving myself completely physically, because if anything happened that would end it, I would be destroyed.
Well, so I think there's a vocabulary recovery issue here, though, that we're missing. And I'm thinking of all the listeners out there who are thinking, okay, I've heard this word before, chastity. It must mean sexual abstinence. And the reason why I brought up the marriage issue so quickly is because fundamental to my worldview is that what it means to be a Christian, in part, is to know that we can't talk about sex without talking about marriage. It's all a part of one composite whole in terms of why God created us sexual beings in the first place. And I think the first thing a lot of people are going to hear when they hear the word chastity is a negative judgment, which means you don't have sex if you're not married. And that's certainly true. But chastity also means that you celebrate sex within the covenant of marriage.
Absolutely. Because chastity is a right ordering of relationships, understanding that sex is meant according to God's plan to take place within the context of a marriage, because it's only within marriage that you can give yourself completely and fully to one another, both physically and emotionally.
I want to go back to something you wrote, though, about what you learned in this great transformation in your life, a transformation that was not only from sexual promiscuity to chastity, but also from being an agnostic to being a Christian and a believer in Christ. But when you look at that great transformation, one of the things that you had to leave behind is this idea that we can be sexually active creatures without it affecting the essence of who we are. It is that very dualism you were talking about. I think most Americans, including many Christians, who are very, very thoughtless about this, and they don't recognize how alien this is from a biblical worldview, they think they have their spiritual selves and their physical selves, and they just happen to coincidentally have the same name.
Well, this is one of the reasons why, as we were saying before, as you were saying, chastity is positive. I am more who I am now as a chaste woman than I ever was when I was having premarital sex. I talk in my book about the difference between being single and being singular. When I was having premarital sex, I was single, which is really being single-minded. If I if I went to a party, I would be looking for that one guy who I might meet. Now, when I go to a social occasion, well, I can't help noticing if there's an attractive man around, but I'm more focused on everyone around and being able to give to people and to really appreciate people. So my view has widened instead of narrowed.
Very, very interesting. You can certainly see why Dawn Eden is the epicenter of some controversy wherever she goes. But the great thing is, she's also the epicenter of moral recovery. And I find fascinating the fact that, that she's now such a popular speaker among student groups and others. Because one of the things we're going to talk about when we return is the fact that a generation raised by the children of the sexual revolution is now coming back to say, there must be something more than this. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program. Maggie Gallagher, in a blurb on the back of Dawn Eden's book, The Thrill of the Chase, asked this question: why would a 30-something modern woman give up sex? At the heart of The Thrill of the Chase is this mysterious story in which, as it unfolds, we find that as she reveals her deep human longing for a love that matters, for a sexual union that is real, a brave, beautiful book. You'll want to get this book. And you'll find it in your local bookstore. You can get it through your online source. It's entitled The Thrill of the Chase. I love the subtitle: Finding Fulfillment While Keeping Your Clothes On. Now, that, folks, is a revolution. Just in the subtitle, right there. Dawn Eden's here in the studio with me. And because of that, we're not going to be taking your calls today. This conversation, we're going to maximize and exploit while we have the opportunity with Dawn Eden here with us. Dawn, you are really popular these days on college and university campuses. How do you explain why, well, a group that a lot of people in this country would say be the least likely to be interested in chastity seem to be so thirsty for a new message?
Young people, when they come to college, especially if they come from a Christian background, they're very scared of being pressured to engage in the premarital sex lifestyle. One of the first things that you hear when you're a new college student is when the resident assistant gives the talk. The resident assistant will say, "And remember, if you ever need condoms, you can knock on my door anytime." So, you know, as soon as they arrive, they're just in the midst of it. And so they really need to feel that it's okay if they don't become part of that, and they need the fellowship that will enable them to have friends without being part of it.
And what happens when you get on these campuses? I know even here, when you're in Louisville this week, you're going to be on a college campus. When you are, you told me you're going to Cincinnati. You're also you've been on many of the Ivy League and other campuses. What do you find when you get there?
What I find when I get there is that they're very interested in what I have to say, and they have a lot of questions. Often the men will have questions about women, because the men want to know, how do they tell a woman that they don't want to get sexually involved with her? Because a lot of times with the women, particularly if they have divorced parents, as I do, they fear rejection, and they think that one way that they can control a relationship is by introducing a physical element, because that way, if there's rejection, they can take charge of the rejection.
At Princeton University now, you have the Anscombe Society. At Harvard, another society and student group. Does it tell us something that in the midst of this sexually confused age, there are students organizing special organizations to encourage each other on campuses such as that towards chastity?
It certainly does, because they need fellowship. They need reinforcement. It's very hard to be chaste if you're the only person in your group who doesn't go out to the bar and try to hook up. So those societies are very necessary. Unfortunately, at campuses, they receive a lot of flack. I've heard that the Harvard one is an abstinence society and not a chastity society, because chastity is considered too controversial. Because by saying that sex should be just for marriage, that it is unfair to homosexuals.
Well, that's one of the reasons why vocabulary recovery is really important, because vocabulary is by its nature a limiting as well as a communicating function. The word means this and not that. And the very fact that chastity has been so central to Western civilization and our moral language, and the fact that chastity does imply, is obstinately, stubbornly imply heterosexuality, it is all of a sudden a word that by its very nature isn't welcomed on the campus of Harvard University.
It implies that there is a correct ordering of one's sexual desire, and that is just right, you know, outside of the bounds in our politically correct society.
I just recently gave an address on sex as an apologetic issue, just trying to get to the heart of the fact that Christians in this culture have a tremendous opportunity to bear witness to the gospel by means of sexuality, by means of a distinctive commitment to chastity, a distinctive commitment to marriage, and a distinctive commitment to the glory of God in the midst of a fallen creation through the recovery of his gift of sexuality in a way that pleases him and is in accordance with his word. In one sense, then, you're kind of an apologist on these campuses.
Well, yes, I am. And also, you know, as you say, it is a witness to the glory of God. And so a chaste individual, if they have the emotional and spiritual resources to live out their chastity, they actually become a magnet for all different kinds of friends, because people like people who don't objectify them. People like people who aren't just out to get something from them. And what being chastity is looking at other people as ends in themselves rather than means to one's own pleasure.
And like every great moral principle, it invades other territories of our lives that are somewhat unexpected. I love, you're a great writer, by the way, and I love one paragraph in your book in which you say your bed figured out chastity long before your closet did. You know, play that out just a little bit.
Well, that's so true, because even as I was first, you know, beginning to, you know, go out at night to nightclubs and know that I was not going to pick up, you know, a sex partner, still I would be going out in these micro mini skirts, and then of course people would treat me a certain way because they would think that I was going out with a certain sexual goal in mind. And I had to learn that I didn't need sexually revealing clothing in order to be attractive or to feel attractive.
At the beginning of the program today, I cited this controversy in Louisiana over girls being turned back from their prom because they were wearing these revealing dresses. They think their rights have been infringed, their prom was taken away from them. What would you say to a 17-year-old girl in that kind of context?
I would say to that girl, you're going to the prom. That means you already have a date. Do you believe that you have to show as much skin as possible in order for your date to care about you? You know, the answer is absolutely not. And the answer is that beauty is not dependent upon how much skin one shows.
You know, that Cosmo rule you so well describe and say you had to leave behind, that sex pushes the relationship. I think that's a formula that can help a lot of parents to understand the message that is being communicated to their children. In some ways, even the message that some parents, perhaps even inadvertently, are communicating to their own children, especially their own daughters. But, you know, we're living in this kind of age in which, let's be really clear about something, chastity is for boys as well as for girls, for men as well as for women. When we come right back, we're gonna talk about why chastity is so important to true masculinity, true femininity, for the glory of God in a fallen world. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Well, this conversation has been just as fascinating as I knew it would be. Dawn Eden is my guest, the author of the book, The Thrill of the Chaste. Dawn, when we were going into the break there, I mentioned that this is a message for men as well as for women.
That's right. It is. And one thing that I discovered after my book came out was that even though my book, being based largely on my own experience, was directed towards women, the audiences at my talks are about 60% male. And I think that's because so much of the abstinence effort has been directed towards women, and men need a model of responsible sexuality as well.
Now, what is the goal of chastity? In one sense, the ultimate goal, of course, has to be, for all human beings, the glory of God.
Yes.
But you also would see, for most human beings, the goal of chastity being the fulfillment of marriage.
Yes, that's right. And the fulfillment of marriage can only be understood when you understand that love is not only meant to be shared with a spouse, but it's also meant to go beyond it, to openness, to procreation, to children, and then beyond that, because when you have children, you become more loving of your community, that, you know, our rights as a nation are dependent upon our rights as a family.
You know, the whole issue of the thrill of the chaste is, it's one of those things that I find delightfully ironic, because the average person on the street hearing someone use the word chastity would think, if you have to use it, it can only be used in a boring context. You're suggesting that there is something exhilarating to chastity.
Well, the exciting thing is that you're not supposed to be having fun while you're doing it. And so if you're having fun, then that gives the lie to the people who say that sexual license is fun. That suggests to them that perhaps their fun isn't quite so much fun after all, and they hate that.
Well, they also hate the fact that you, in a very prophetic and just undeniable way, have pointed out that the fruits of the sexual revolution did not turn out to be personal happiness and fulfillment and strong marriages and all the rest, but rather turned out to be the debris of adultery, of divorce, and of incalculable human pain. Don Eden, if you could distill your thesis down to just a few seconds, if someone said to you, what exactly are you all about, what would you say?
Chastity is about living out all the graces that you've been given as a human being. That's what I would say, because it teaches you that this life is not supposed to be this narcissistic experience where you're just trying to take out of it. This life is about giving and sharing the graces that you've been given by God.
Beautifully said. And Dawn, thank you for joining me on the program today.
Thank you so much.
The author was Dawn Eden. The title of the book is The Thrill of the Chaste, Finding Fulfillment While Keeping Your Clothes On. Folks, this is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. That's what we've been about today. Continue this conversation at your home, your workplace, and in your church. Let's recover the word chastity while there's time. I'll be back tomorrow for intelligent Christian conversation. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.